Welcome to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services, a show about coping with getting older ourselves and dealing with our aging parents. If you have questions about how to cope with these stresses, call Scott at 877-960-9960. Now, here's Scott.
Welcome, everybody. Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom, here tonight with a very special guest, a guest I've been looking forward to this show for a very long time. I mean that sincerely. This is unlike any show I've ever done before. It has nothing to do with you getting older. It has nothing to do with your mom or dad getting older. All this is about is some valuable information about a subject that I'll bet you haven't thought much about, or maybe you've thought too much about. If you're new to us, we're on three stations. We're on 95.9 and 106.9 on... 106.9 on the Treasure Coast, 95.9 in Palm Beach County. We also rebroadcast on Long Island, 103.9, Long Island's talk radio station on Wednesday evenings. If it's Monday night, we're live. If it's Sunday morning and you're listening to us, we're on tape. We hope that you have a great day ahead. If you're on 95, be careful. Of course, we're also on iHeartRadio. You can even just shout at Alexa or Echo, say, tune in to True Oldies Florida every Monday night at 6, and you will find us. So what about tonight's show? David Hirschberg is here, and David's a fascinating gentleman who's become a true expert in our Constitution. But even more than that, he discusses our formation as a nation from a perspective that few of us have ever had the time or ability to understand. Given our charged political environment today, perhaps a better understanding of where we came from might help us find more common ground. I'm really excited about David being here, and trust me, you need to stay tuned because he's a most interesting gentleman with a lot of useful information. But before I get to David, a few things. For those of you who are interested in the difference between normal aging and Alzheimer's disease, I will be giving a presentation on that very subject this Thursday morning at 8:30 in the morning at ARTIS, A-R-T-I-S, ARTIS Memory Care Assisted Living in Boca Raton, Florida. If you'd like to learn more about this subject, the difference between Alzheimer's and normal aging, call ARTIS and make a reservation. They would love to have you, and I'll be glad to see you. I'll also be at Ruth Rail's Jewish Family Services on Friday at 11, talking about how to utilize one's social history in building a plan of care. Many of you, if you're regular listeners, know that I'm 68 years old, and my grandchildren think I fell out of a tree at 68. They have no idea where I came from. They have no idea what my life was like prior to us getting to where we are today. But if you're dealing with somebody with a chronic disease, understanding where they came from can help immeasurably in treating them with the kind of respect and providing care that otherwise they would not get. I also want to tell you that just parenthetically, I'm excited to be attending Albert Jewish Family and Children's Services No Excuse for Abuse Luncheon this week, where the guest speaker will be Monica Lewinsky. Given today's news flow, this promises to be a most interesting event. But more importantly, don't forget to support organizations like Albert Jewish Family and Children's Service, who do important work and bring topical subject matter designed to be helpful to so many. But now I want to get to my guest, David Hirschberg. Who is David? Well, David grew up in Queens. He graduated from NYU, Phi Beta Kappa. He went to Harvard Law School and graduated in 1965, and he took an advanced management degree from Columbia Business School. In the Army, he studied Russian at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. He was then Deputy General Counsel at American Express, Vice Chairman and General Counsel at Shearson Lehman Brothers, which became Lehman. He was also on their board of directors, and he finished his business career as head of IBM Corporate Legal Group. He's been on a number of boards since retirement, but more importantly, he's proud of the fact that he's very active in two charities, particularly the ADL, and he served as committee chair on a number of their committees, and Echoing Green, a charity that funds and otherwise supports social entrepreneurs around the world. He teaches the Constitutional Convention course at a number of venues. He's read over 30 books on the subject matter, and he truly is expert at this subject. So, David, welcome to Oh My God. How are you?
Thank you. The one thing I want to say from the very beginning is I love talking about this subject. And I love answering questions about this subject. How did I come to that? Since
yes.
I never in my life did one constitutional law matter in my entire legal career. It was like, to coin a present phrase, viral. I started with one book. It fascinated me, and I kept reading more and more books, and it came to pass that I realized this was one remarkable, remarkable period in human history when it came to governance. Between the Enlightenment, a new fertile country, an educated and literate populace in the colonies, the 1780s culminated in the Constitutional Convention. How did we get there? Well, first, at a high level, I want to make two very important observations that no matter what else you hear, this is the context. First, the people who came to this country came across the Atlantic, and it was somewhat different than a transatlantic crossing now. No private suites, no shampoo, no conditioner. It was brutal. It was dangerous. They risked life and limb, and they really didn't know where they were going and what would be there when they got there. So these people were very much self-starters or escaping things that made their life miserable. For our purposes...
Just to pause for a minute.
Yeah.
That's why they came. Their lives were miserable. They nobody came here because they were swimming in the land of luxury back in the old country.
Mostly true, right. Although...
I guess there are exceptions.
The nobles in primarily England got land grants, and they brought people with them who would be senior people. But by and large, the people who came were poor, somewhat literate, but not very, and were escaping poverty and religious persecution. For our purposes, the important thing to realize, and when I mean our purposes, what culminated in the Constitutional Convention, is that as they settled from Maine down to the South, they started very different lives. The topography, the weather, the soil, all drove them to do different things. So we talked about New England, we talked about the Mid-Atlantic, we talked about the South. They all felt and thought locally. There was never any notion until almost the time of the Declaration of Independence that they were a nation. They didn't even think of themselves as necessarily citizens of a particular colony until population grew. So those differences became very significant political, economic, and cultural differences that were barriers and significant reasons why it became so difficult to agree upon a constitution.
So with that backdrop, David, the concept that all of the colonists were swimming in the same direction is an anathema. It's not possible because, as you said, everybody came to this either from different locations or had we're going to talk a lot about this during the course of the evening, but the South, right, South Carolina and Rhode Island couldn't have been any further apart than the man in the moon is to us today. So they didn't really understand that not only weren't they not part of the United States of America, that wasn't even a conceptual idea. They, as you said, didn't even know they belonged to a state.
As I say in my presentation, the Constitution, and before that the Revolution, were never in the minds of the colonists until maybe 10, 15 years before the Declaration of Independence. So an evolution to thinking democratically became a revolution only in a very short period of time leading up to the Declaration of Independence. And so why did these diverse people and colonies revolt? Not because they had significant common interest, except for one. They had a common enemy.
Right.
They had a common enemy in England. And that's what brought them together, not any real desire to form a united country.
So how did the process begin? How do we go from your explanation of where we were prior to the Declaration of Independence to the Declaration of Independence and then the next steps?
Okay, well, ironically, one of the ways we got there was because it was an English colony. Think about way back then. Think about the Spanish Empire or the French Empire or even the Dutch Empire. The notion of independence and actually rebelling against those empires was totally far-fetched. In a certain respect, the English were their own worst enemy. They had, however you want to phrase it, the most progressive, liberal, democratic government in the world. Now, we always think of them as we were learning about the revolution. They were the bad guys and we were the good guys. Relative to the rest of the world, the English were the best guys.
Right.
They had a parliament that was active and vocal and getting more and more progressive as the years went on. The Whigs in Parliament were very populist, and they were challenging the power of the king. So the mindset of being an English colony was totally different than the mindset of other colonies. And of course, the Enlightenment cast enormous light on political theory at that time, whether it was Montesquieu, John Locke, John Mill. Our colonists started reading those particular political theorists, all of whom were emphasizing democracy. And the English permitted the local colonies to, in fact, have local governance. There were town halls, there were local courts, and the more people got used to creating rules and processes for themselves, the more their minds opened up when they saw the kind of abuses or the perceived abuses they thought the king and the English Empire was heaping upon them. We all talk about taxation without representation and the Stamp Act. That was a piece of it. But the English had soldiers on the ground in the colonies who abused their military power and occupied people's homes when they wanted to. So there was a general feeling of being not just disenfranchised, but being abused by the English. But again, once again, relative to the rest of the world, the English could be considered saints.
So given that there are different influences in Massachusetts, and I use South Carolina, but it could be anywhere, how did it come that they could find even the wherewithal to come together to begin to conceive of the idea of a revolution? Or what drives them together? What was the process that brings these disparate communities, for lack of a better term, together to unify against this common enemy?
It would be the kind of networking that people have if they have things in common. And despite the fact that the colonies had lots that was not in commonality, commerce. People traveled extensively up and down the coast, especially in the mid-Atlantic and in the New England states. There was an excess of newspapers that were constantly talking about what was going on. The interest in politics and being English subjects was very, very significant at that time. And when you think about the agriculture in the South, how did the cotton that they had on their plantations get to England? It was through New York. New York became the hub of commerce for almost all of the 13 colonies. Manufacturing, how did they get their stuff out of the United States? through New York. And, of course, there was interstate commerce as well. I should call it intercolony commerce as well.
Right.
Manufacturing was used to supply goods and merchandise to those people in the South. The South was overwhelmingly agricultural, but interestingly enough, at the beginning, especially, most citizens of the South did not have slaves. The political structure of the South was driven quite differently because when cotton became the major crop, plantation owners became the dominant force in all of the Southern states. Unlike the other states where there was a more spread out kind of education and power structure, the South was dominated by plantation owners, and the politics were concentrated, the power politics of the South were concentrated in the hands of mostly the plantation owners.
So who are these guys, you know, that come to represent the colonies? And they come together. These aren't like our elected officials today, I'm assuming, right? They didn't have the second Tuesday or the first Tuesday in November to do this. So how does that begin? Because we all think, and that's the point of tonight's show, mm-hmm. we all think everything about the Constitution is inviolate. It is exactly as it says. But we need to understand how we got to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So who are these guys?
Well, these guys, even at the time of the Declaration of Independence, were not thinking about a constitution. In fact, when you ask people, what does the Declaration of Independence tell us about governance? The answer is nothing. There is not a single word in the Declaration of Independence about how, if we became independent, we would govern ourselves. It's a beautiful and passionate expression for independence, but it has absolutely nothing to do with governance. And as I said before, the only reason independence was declared was because of this violent reaction to the British. Now, let's be clear. This was not all hands resisting the British. If you wanted to cut up the pie in three pieces, most people couldn't have given a damn.
Right.
There were as many loyalists as there were revolutionaries. So the notion that everyone was shoulder to shoulder and willing to fight and declare independence is a totally false one. Many, many people thought we were insane, that how could you go against the largest empire in the world, the strongest military and the largest navy. So there was a lot of dispute about whether this made any sense. And in fact, as the Revolutionary War progressed, we were not so, let's say, honorable in terms of how we dealt with the loyalists. When the war finally ended, there were like 60,000 people living in tents, displaced people, and many, many people were tarred and feathered and died as the result of them being loyalists and the revolutionaries obviously not wanting to tolerate that.
Well, to the victors go the spoils in some respect, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that's what we're talking about.
So the war lasted a long time and spread out over a lot of geography, which, of course, was very helpful to the colonists because the English had supply line issues. They had other major political and commercial interests. The sugar trade was much more lucrative to them at that time, and there were many in Parliament who argued, let's not focus on what became the United States. Let's focus on the sugar trade. So it wasn't as if the English were all in the same place on what to do about the colonists as well. So as the war wore on, the English wore down. And finally, they surrendered. And there were some people who had the foresight to put pen to paper at that time, I should say quill to paper, and say, I have a document. And this document is going to be the basis for us to declare our independence and govern ourselves.
And that is the beginning of the formation of what would later become the Constitution.
No.
Right.
No. No. That document was the Articles of Confederation.
Okay.
Not the Constitution.
No, but was that not the forerunner?
Yes. Yeah, it was the forerunner. But the key to understanding the Articles of Confederation was what I said at the very top of this. Every single state still viewed itself as sovereign.
Right.
They did not view themselves as wanting to give up power to a central government.
Which is why we still struggle with that in today's world. Mm-hmm. And so the backdrop that we're doing here is laying the foundation for us to go through the rest of how the Constitution was formed, and then we'll bring it into today's world. If you're just tuning in, it's Scott Greenberg on Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom. I'm here tonight with David Hirschberg. David is, as you can tell, an expert in the formation of the Constitution and the Constitution itself. We are talking about where we came from, and if you want to know where we are, you can only appreciate that in the context of where we came from. It's a most interesting subject, one that we've never done before. If you're listening on 95.9 or 106.9, we're live. It's Monday night. We hope you had a great day. Drive carefully. All right. We hope you're enjoying the show. If you're on Long Island, 103.9, we are there as well. If you have questions for my guest, you can reach out to us here at 1-877-960-9960. That's 1-877-960-9960.
Yeah, I can attest to the fact that he's getting old.
No, he's not. You're not on now.
Oh.
I'm here with Allison from Comfort Care Senior Services. Allison, at Comfort Care, you guys are proud to be a family-owned and operated business.
That's right, Mike. It's myself and my husband, Tino, my sister, Melissa, and her husband, Joe, and my parents, Irene and Scott Greenberg. As you can tell by six family members being able to work together, family is extremely important to us. Our clients often have kids that live out of state or even overseas, and those extended family members want to have the comfort of being able to contact a family member at any time to follow up on how mom or dad is doing. While you are able to reach a family member at any time, our office staff is truly part of our extended family. They monitor the phones 24/7 in case of an emergency and are empowered to make decisions that are in the best interest of the client, because at Comfort Care, it's the quality of care, not the severity of your condition, that determines the quality of life. Call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620, or visit our website at palmbeach.comfortcare.com. That's palmbeach.comfortcare.com.
Do your parents live in South Florida? We know it can be difficult to be there for them when you live far away. As mom and dad get older, things can change in an instant. Are you prepared? Finding a trusted local expert to coordinate and provide care makes all the difference. Elder Care 360 can provide you and your family the proper guidance, support, and education to resolve everyday issues that can impact healthcare challenges and more. As a patient advocate, Elder Care 360 brings together decades of experience as patient-focused professionals to assist you and your families with their routine activities of living and healthcare challenges. Being proactive is the best way to ensure the best possible outcome for you and your family during these times. Call us to see how we can help before the crisis at 561-713-1800. Make Elder Care 360 part of your team. Elder Care 360, patient advocacy, coordination of services, and full circle of care. 561-713-1800.
I'm here with Melissa from Comfort Care Senior Services. Melissa, caregiver stress is a real condition, and it's becoming an epidemic.
That's right, Mike. Chronic diseases like Parkinson's, MS, Alzheimer's, cancer, among others, affect more than just the person with the diagnosis. They affect the entire family, oftentimes putting added stress on the primary family caregiver. In fact, 64% of family caregivers who do not seek outside help will predecease their loved one living with Alzheimer's disease. Even just a few hours of respite care a week can give someone a much-needed break so that they can be the best caregiver they can be. Whether it's time to schedule a hair appointment, a card game, an exercise class, or lunch with friends. Remember, it's the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines their quality of life. Let our family take care of your family. Call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620. 1620.
Welcome back to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services. Reach Scott with your questions, 877-960-9960. Now, back to Scott.
Welcome back, everybody. Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom. And if you're as old as me, you may have forgotten some of the civics lessons that we learned when we were back in grade school. Understanding the formation of the United States was really important back in the day. But again, if you're like me, those days, those memories are probably long gone. But we're talking to a guest tonight who is a constitutional expert. And the Constitution is critical in today's political environment. And we're going to talk about how that plays to where we are today with the discord about that. But in order to know where we are today, we have to understand where we came from. My guest, David Hirschberg, is an expert on the Constitution, and we are talking about its formation. We talked up to about the Revolutionary War. Now we're going to talk about the Articles of Confederation, which was, my words, the precursor to what became the Constitution. So let's talk through that a little.
Although at the time, they were in thinking precursor, they were thinking they were crafting a definitive document to govern the 13 colonies. But lo and behold, what they did was craft a document that was totally ineffectual in terms of governance. The fear of a strong central government, the fear of a standing army, the fear of the power to tax, and the desire of each of the 13 colonies to remain sovereign made the Articles Confederation completely ineffectual. Every state had the right to approve or disapprove the funding of any executive action. The executive under the Articles of Confederation was basically a eunuch, had no power whatsoever to do much of anything. And if the reasons for the Articles of Confederation were to regulate the commercial relationship between the states and to protect the country and to conduct diplomacy, they gave the executive very little power to do so. And over the course of time, the relationship among the states worsened and worsened, especially between the North and the South. And at some point, I would say the word desperation is the appropriate word to describe what drove a small group of people to decide that they needed to amend the Articles of Confederation. Lo and behold, what happened was that small group of people actually wanted to replace the Articles of Confederation. And when the first meeting of the Constitutional Convention convened, interestingly enough, a number of them were quite surprised at the direction it was taking. And the 56, I believe, original delegates from 12, not 13 states, Rhode Island did not show up. Out of the 56, about a dozen up and left, never to return, because they disagreed with the notion of replacing the Articles of Confederation. So what you had was a small group of people from 12 states. You can do the arithmetic and say what's the average number of people from each delegation, sitting for about 4 or 5 months in a very hot, steamy room in Philadelphia, doors and windows closed, debating what the next step in governance should be. So let me repeat the word I used before. Many of them were desperate. Some were more desperate than others. And those who were more desperate, basically from the North and the Mid-Atlantic, were more easily manipulated into making concessions as the negotiations proceeded.
So, what was their common thread? Was it just economic?
No, it was economic in the sense that the competition among the states in commerce was bitter. States were imposing tariffs and taxes on goods and services from each other. But equally, if not more important, when you go back to why the Articles of Confederation were even conceived, was international affairs. Spain and France were still interested in being on the continent. In fact, they still were. There was a significant risk of invasion. There was a significant risk of, given the weakness of the Articles of Confederation, that individual states could form alliances with the major European powers. New York, in particular, being the commercial center, had a lot of leverage in terms of saying, I could renew my ties to the English. That was not a far-fetched idea at all. And, of course, with no standing army, what would stop any empire from deciding it wanted to invade the United States again? The only thing that might stop it was another empire. And the ground that these people lived on was clearly exposed to a lot of international risk.
So ultimately, though, they did come together. They did find enough common ground. I know the process was arduous. We usually take a break now, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to skip this break, Mike, if it's okay. We get to the point, and we can come back to it later if we have some more time. But we get to the point where they draft this document, the Constitution of the United States, and its passage was not certain.
Right. Its passage, well, let me make two points. One, the most important issues that were debated and intensely debated were the rights and powers of the small states versus the large states.
Right.
And that's how, despite differences in population, small states, every state has the right to two senators. And every state has the right to at least two electors in the Electoral College to vote for the president. So the smaller states managed to extract some concessions along those lines. The other major area where concessions were required, because there was a mortal fear that the Southern delegations would just not go along. And by the way, you needed 9 of the, in theory, 13, but only 12 showed up, 9 of the states to ratify the document, or I should say approve the document in order for it to be binding. But put that arithmetic aside for one second. The concessions that the North had to make to the South on slavery, to use my word, were obscene.
Right.
And it was a bitter, bitter struggle. Despite the fact that slaves were not citizens, they counted for 3/5 of a person for purposes of the number of people in the House of Representatives and for the number of delegates in the Electoral College. There was a prohibition against stopping the importation of slaves until 1808. There was a law that basically provided that runaway slaves had to be returned by free states. It was a very lopsided negotiation. You have to ask yourself, if you were a abolitionist in Boston, would you, in the interests of unifying a country, have made those concessions? It's hard to obviously imagine, but that was the case.
So now we're in 2018, all right, and we're further on down the road, and all of the things that they were dealing with in the context of what they were dealing with at that time include things that we live with today. Now, they also amended the Constitution. We'll talk about that in a second. But the Constitution, in no particular order, we'll come back while we're talking about amendments, but transportation, international relations, the Electoral College, three branches of government, the slavery rights versus white supremacy that you're talking about, specifically the thing that's driving everybody nuts today, First and Second Amendments, term limits, campaign financing, the Supreme Court. Not all of these are dealt with, but some of them are. But we're dealing with those today in the context of what you described. Now, we get approval. All right. We have the 13 or the 12 participants of the 13 states. We get 9 to finally approve it. We have a new constitution. And then we got to
We don't have a new constitution.
Okay.
And you have hit upon one of the wonderful dynamics that took place in that room. Because all that they were negotiating was a proposed constitution.
Okay.
Each of the delegates had to decide whatever he agreed to, and there were no she's, there were only founding fathers, there were no founding mothers.
I'm in enough trouble after tonight.
It is what it is. They had to decide if the document that was being proposed would not only be a good document for the convention delegates themselves, but it had to be ratified by every single one of the states. Can you imagine the risk of a handful of people speculating on what this negotiation rendered would be approved by their respective states? And the respective states were not going to be the state legislatures. It was not going to be a popular vote in the state. Each state had to form its own new ratification convention. And so they made a very crucial decision at the Constitutional Convention. Once they agreed on the language, they decided that each of the ratification delegations in the states had to take it on an all-or-nothing basis. No amendments would be accepted. Now, why did they do that? Everything was so speculative. Everything was open-ended to begin with, and compromises were made. How could they have predicted that on that basis, the ratification process would have approved it? Well, I guess it became practical. As I said, they were desperate. There was a sense of urgency. The notion that each separate state would then come back with other amendments that had to be reconsidered, they realized that the process could have been never-ending and that they never would have agreed on a document that could be approved, because once they accepted amendments, who's to say that those states, again, would object to some of those amendments?
Right.
So they decided all or nothing. And believe it or not, every state delegation lobbed dozens, if not hundreds, of amendments over the transom.
Well, I'm stunned.
And believe it or not, every single one was rejected. Okay. Now let's get into the arithmetic.
Right.
Because just like you needed 9 out of 12 of the delegations at the Constitutional Convention, you needed 9 out of 13 of the states to ratify the Constitution before it would be binding. It's a false notion when you think about it. The first 8 states that approved or ratified the Constitution did not include New York or Virginia, the 2 most important states, perhaps next with Massachusetts in there. The 9th state to approve it was New Hampshire. Just imagine if those 9 states were the only states that constituted the United States of America then, how long would that nation last? Geographically, with New York and Virginia in between, economically, with the commerce and the agricultural power of those 2 states, militarily, where would they get the money to raise an army? So the notion that 9 out of 13 would have resulted in a United States, it may have legally, But I would surmise, especially given foreign alliances being what they were, that that nation never would have survived.
So if you're just tuning in, it's Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom, here tonight with David Hirschberg, who is a constitutional expert on the formation of the Constitution. As soon as we come back, we're going to talk about the amendment process, which will get us towards kind of where we are today. We don't have to debate that necessarily, and we will or won't, but we're now at the point that the Constitution is ratified, and now we're going to talk about amendments. So if you're just tuning in, Scott Greenberg, Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom, 95.9 and 106.9 FM here in Palm Beach on the Treasure Coast. If you're on Long Island, 103.9 Long Island's talk radio station. We hope you're having a great day. We're glad that you're with us. If you have any questions for my guest or for me, call us at 1-877-960-9960. That's 1-877-960-9960.
I'm here with Melissa from Comfort Care Senior Services. Melissa, at Comfort Care, you're an agency, not a nurse registry, right?
Yes, Mike. When looking at home care in South Florida, there are two types of companies, and on the front, we look very much the same. We're an agency, which means all of our caregivers are our employees. They are licensed, bonded, and insured. We pay the professional liability insurance, we pay the workers' comp insurance, the overtime, and we pay the employment taxes. In other words, we are the true employer. When working with a nurse registry, the client is the employer, and that matters. Another big difference is the ability to train. Agencies are allowed to train, and we do. We conduct both field training and in-home training. A nurse registry's caregivers are deemed experts in their field and therefore are not allowed to be trained by the registry over and above what the state requires. We also have a very rigorous hiring process. The caregiver pool in South Florida is huge, and we strive to hire the top 20%. We do that in a few ways, including testing, interviews, background checks over and above what the state requires, and passing the family test. Remember, it's the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines their quality of life. Let our family take care of your family. Call us at 561-630-1620.
Do your parents live in South Florida? We know it can be difficult to be there for them when you live far away. As mom and dad get older, things can change in an instant. Are you prepared? Finding a trusted local expert to coordinate and provide care makes all the difference. Elder Care 360 can provide you and your family the proper guidance, support, and education to resolve everyday issues that can impact healthcare challenges and more. As a patient advocate, Elder Care 360 brings together decades of experience as patient-focused professionals to assist you and your families with their routine activities of living and healthcare challenges. Being proactive is the best way to ensure the best possible outcome for you and your family during these times. Call us to see how we can help before the crisis at 561-713-1800. Make Elder Care 360 part of your team. Elder Care 360, patient advocacy, coordination of services, and full circle of care. 561-713-1800.
I'm here with Scott Greenberg from Comfort Care Senior Services. Scott, you're very involved when it comes to the senior community.
That's right, Mike. We firmly believe that involvement in the community, giving back to the community, comes back to us in many, many ways. One of the ways it comes back to us is in our understanding of what's going on, what's new, what's trending. So we're very involved in the guardianship community, for example. We're involved in Alzheimer's community care, in the Alzheimer's Association, in Parkinson's. We run support groups. Basically, what I'm saying is that we want to be a part of the community in ways that we just don't receive benefit, but that we can give benefit as well. It's very important for us to understand the needs of the entire community and the needs of other people who are providing services. It is only through that that we can ensure that we provide the best care possible. Remember, Mike, it's the quality of care, not the severity of one's condition, that determines the quality of their life. So remember, let our family take care of your family and call us at 561-630-1620. That's 561-630-1620, or look us up on the web at palmbeach.comfortcare.com.
Welcome back to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older and So Is My Mom with Scott Greenberg of Comfort Care Senior Services. Reach Scott with your questions, 877-960-9960. Now, back to Scott.
Welcome back, everybody. Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom. If you're just tuning in, you're missing one hell of a show. You really are. I'm here tonight with David Hirschberg. David is a constitutional expert. I could read you his entire bio, but it would take the rest of the show. But he has taught constitutional convention courses at a number of venues. We're trying to get him to do a course here in Palm Beach next year down at the JCC in Boynton Beach. We'll announce that when it becomes real. But we're talking about that. If you're listening on 106.9 or 95.9, we're glad that you're with us here on True Oldies. We're here every Monday night from 6 to 7. We rebroadcast Sunday mornings at 7 o'clock. And, of course, we're on Long Island at 103.9 FM every Wednesday night for those of you up there. So we've traveled the formation of the United States of America to the point where the Constitution is now approved. Let's talk about amendments, because we spend an awful lot of time in this country talking about amendments. You have an entirely different viewpoint of amendments, and I think it's really, really important. So let's talk about it.
Okay, so first, it's important to understand that the proposed Constitution did not address individual rights. The Constitution, I think, only uses the word people twice. We the people at the very beginning, and the notion that we the people are the basis for the document is really sort of the revolutionary concept, the first time a government was ever sort of developed from the bottoms up as opposed to someone granting powers from the top down. Having said that, if you read the original Constitution with no amendments, it's not about granting people rights. It's about power and it's about process. And as long as you understand what it is, it's rules of government, how the government should or should not govern the people, and what rights it should or could grant is what it's all about. But interestingly enough, during the ratification process, most of the states wanted something called a Bill of Rights in the body of the Constitution. And there were fierce arguments about whether or not a Bill of Rights is an appropriate part of a Constitution. Interestingly enough, Madison, who is considered the father of the Constitution and drafted the better part of it, was staunchly opposed to a Bill of Rights until the very end. And when he saw all of the states wanted a Bill of Rights, he realized that ratification might be at risk if it did not include one. Right. So one of the promises made by the Federalists was that once the Constitution was approved, one of the first things that they would do is consider a Bill of Rights. So between the period when the Constitution was proposed and its ratification, there were fascinating debates and articles. Do you know exactly what went on in every single state? Do you know what the Federalist Papers were?
I really don't, and I doubt most of my listeners do.
The Federalist Papers, which we revere now because they're the most incredibly articulate, well-written documents about governance, were not, neutral pieces describing the proposed Constitution. They were stark advocacy pieces trying to make sure that the Constitution was ratified. And they were written under nom de plumes by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. They used Roman names, Publius. And the newspaper articles were put in by people with nom de plumes arguing strenuously for ratification. When the document was finally ratified, and it eventually became ratified by all 13 states, two of which only ratified it after the first Congress was convened, the first significant action they took was to consider what we now call the Bill of Rights, the 10 amendments to the Constitution. One of the things to notice about the First Amendment in particular, but the second and a few others, is all of a sudden, it's not about process. All of a sudden, the First Amendment has words about freedom of speech and freedom of religion and freedom of assembly, but no embellishment. It's just the most simple language. Now, what does that mean? What does freedom of speech mean? Well, it's taken centuries and ongoing to define what that means. The Constitution just sort of dropped that in there. Same thing with freedom of religion. What does that mean? We have volumes and volumes of judicial decisions trying to figure out what those words mean. And we still haven't figured it out. So the most living part of the Constitution was the Bill of Rights.
So would it be fair to say that based on what you just said, what it meant then and what it means today don't necessarily have to be the same?
And, of course, you've hit upon one of these ongoing theoretical arguments between a strict interpretation of the Constitution saying what did they have in mind when they wrote those words and the living Constitution, which at its extreme makes the courts a legislature, which is one of the more interesting dynamics that have now taken place. Because back in 1787, they had no notion about how complicated life would be, how complex legislation would be. And so the notion of judicial review, which is not literally in the Constitution, the right of the Supreme Court to declare either an act or a piece of law in violation of the Constitution, was only read into it a few decades later by John Marshall, has become the notion that the Supreme Court, I could almost say, represents the ultimate legislature. And if there's a swing vote on the Supreme Court, he could be the most powerful person in America at any particular point in time.
So if you're just tuning in, it's Scott Greenberg. Oh, my God, I'm getting older. So is my mom, here tonight with David Hirschberg, who is a constitutional expert. And as you've seen, we have built the path. I'm going to ask my guest to come back at a later date to go further. We're going to talk about that. But if you missed the show and you're sorry you did, if you're just tuning in late, the good news is you can listen to it because we podcast. Yes, we do. We podcast. Just go to the podcast platform and search OMG, I'm getting up, we will pop. If you're not a podcaster, you can go to my website, palmbeach.comfortcare.com. Comfort Care, C-O-M-F-O-R-C-A-R-E. Don't put a T in there. As much as you'd like to, don't do that. Palmbeach.comfortcare.com. Click on the radio button and you can listen to this and to any of the other shows that we've done. Of course, if you don't have a radio, it does not matter because you have a smartphone, and there is an app for that. It is called TuneIn Radio. All you have to do is download the free TuneIn Radio app, set yourself a reminder every Monday night at 6 o'clock, set it for WSVU, 960 AM, which is the broadcast channel it's on, and you can get us. And then wherever you are, local, across the state, across the nation, or across the world, we simulcast. www.trueoldiesfla.com. Next week, we're going to talk about mental health. It's in the news every day, especially given the conversation about gun control. We need better mental health. What is mental health? What's mental illness? They are not the same. And we're going to talk about how you can understand the difference, why that is critical, and it will help you have an informed conversation. I will have two guests next week, both named Pam. It will be hard to determine which one is which, but Pam Gianfrido is the CEO of the Mental Health Association of Palm Beach County, and Pam McCrory, who is a certified PEARLS counselor. PEARLS is a program we're going to talk about. You really need to understand this. It's going to be great. In 2 weeks, Dr. Joseph Ricotta, who is a vascular surgeon, who is doing truly remarkable cutting-edge surgery, having just completed the first in the nation robotic procedure for PVI. I know Dr. Ricotta. He's a wonderful guest. He's entertaining, and he's just marvelous, and you are going to love listening to him. But I have a few minutes left with my guest, David Hirschberg. David is that constitutional expert we've talking about tonight. David, I know you have some thoughts that you would like to leave everybody with before the show ends.
I normally end my course, it's a three-session course, saying at the end of the first session, the Constitution is a remarkable document. It's an enduring document. But is the Constitution still, in whole or in part, a viable document in today's world with all of the changes that have taken place in our society and around the world? And let me just list some of the top issues, many of which you're thinking about, obviously. The Second Amendment, is it still viable? Term limits on people in Congress, is that still viable? The Electoral College, given the fact that in recent years the popular vote getter hasn't necessarily won the presidential election. The growth of something the Founding Fathers never conceived of, a mammoth federal bureaucracy that promulgates rules that affect us every single day, the power of the Supreme Court, which I alluded to before. But one of the ones that I think is most interesting is the amendment process in the Constitution. Let me ask Scott, how many amendments were there?
Well, we have 27, I know, because you prompted me. Okay. We have 27, but I'm not sure. I thought it was 25 before tonight.
Okay. But let's take a look at those 27 and first ask yourself, is the amendment process in this country too easy, too difficult, or just right? But let's take a look at the 27 amendments that have taken place since 1787. The first 10 were literally part of the deal, if you will, to generate the Constitution and have it approved and be functional. So that brings your 27 down to 17. Then the three after the Civil War were basically imposed because the North won and the South lost. And so they freed the slaves, they gave them the right to vote, and they passed the Equal Protection Amendment, which basically said the rights that people have as federal citizens also have to be respected by the states. So it diluted the whole notion of a federal republic. Didn't get rid of it. We still have those issues. So those three, if you will, bring the 17 down to 14. Then we have the two ha-ha amendments. Prohibition and getting rid of prohibition. The best thing you can say about prohibition is it established the crime families in this country, and they're still with us. And the other significant ones were women's rights to vote, an income tax, 18-year-old to given the right to vote, term limits on the president. So I would submit, and there were a few others, out of the 27, after the Bill of Rights and the Civil War, there are only about five or six amendments that really made major transformations in the way this country is governed. And the amendment process, take a look at Article 5, is very, very detailed and requires supermajorities at both the federal and the state level. So you decide, given that profile, is this an amendment process that is conducive to dealing with the list, the short list of items I just raised, term limits, for instance, or otherwise?
It's really a fascinating subject. It gets you to think about the Constitution in a different way. You are really a marvelous guest. I really appreciate your coming here. I know I interrupted either your tennis game or dinner, but I appreciate it.
Physical and mental therapy.
but I so appreciate what you've brought to the table, and I hope that I can entice you one day to come back and we can talk further about what I think is really critical in your position here, which is, is the Constitution, as it is being presented us today, what the Founding Fathers in fact saw? How could they? They could never have envisioned what we are facing here. If If you're a regular listener to Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom, this is a little different show. We're not talking about issues that confront boomers and their parents, but it does affect our everyday dinner and our conversation with our neighbors and our kids, and it really brings a new understanding, I hope, to our understanding of why we live in the greatest nation in the world and why we still have the challenges that we do. We are here every Monday night on Oh My God, I'm Getting Older, So Is My Mom. We do it live. We do it at 6 o'clock on 95.9 FM and 106.9 FM on the Treasure Coast. We rebroadcast on Long Island at 103.9, Long Island's Talk Radio, and again here, 7 o'clock every Sunday morning. So you can do that. You can also listen, of course, on podcast or on the website. We talk about issues that confront boomers and their parents. Next week, we're going to be talking about mental health versus mental illness. It's a subject matter that you really need to listen to. We're glad that you're with us. We're glad you were here tonight. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next week. Oh, my God, I'm getting older, and so is my mom. Have a good night, all.